Hey listeners, welcome to Trust in Tech, where we have conversations with folks helping the internet and society thrive. As a reminder, the views stated in this episode are not affiliated with any organization and only represent the views of the individuals. I hope you enjoy the show. It's June, which means it's Pride, and so I am here with Alex. We're going to talk about all things LGBTQ+. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. I'm Alex Levitt. My pronouns are they, them, and I'm a researcher who's worked in trust and safety for close to a decade now. I wear a bunch of different hats. So currently I'm a researcher at Roblox, leading up their trust and safety work. I'm a visiting fellow at UC Berkeley at their Center for Human Compatible AI, and I'm also a member of the Integrity Institute.
I wanted to start this conversation talking about, like, what is the experience online like generally for the queer community right now? What is it actually like, and how are people actually experiencing social media, especially right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly a difficult moment for a lot of people, but at the same time, there's so many benefits out there. So I feel like if we look at the history of social media and how the queer community has engaged with it over time, we've seen a really interesting shift from, like, really niche communities into much larger social networks. Obviously, a bunch of dating apps that have grown over time, specifically for LGBTQ+ individuals. And then just generally, a lot of the debates around the community that have kind of picked up in the past few years, just being super common across most platforms. There's also elements of, like, entertainment and games and shopping that we could possibly talk about as well. But I think that there's probably themes that we can tease apart. So the first one is just the way in which the internet has provided so much support for queer folk. So being able to express your identity, being able to experiment with that identity, being able to connect with people, both offline and online, where it would be hard to find people like that maybe a few decades ago. And so the flip side of that coin is all the other issues that come with that. So I think one of the moments that we're in right now is we have a situation politically where things have gotten so bad where the Human Rights Campaign is literally declaring a state of emergency in the United States for queer people. And that's just the reality of the situation, which sucks. And what that leads to is we have a bunch of participation on social technology platforms that is detrimental and harmful. And so that could be direct attacks against LGBTQ people. It could be discussions that are just impacting general public opinion against our community. And I think a lot of what's coming to the forefront now is a struggle between balancing these two sides of the coin, one where there are so many benefits for LGBTQ+ communities, for finding people, getting access to information, et cetera. And yet we're still struggling with core trust and safety issues. And I think the large question right now is, can technology companies be doing better to help protect people against those abuses?
Yeah, you pulled together some really good information before this discussion. I think it's worth highlighting one of them, which is the Microsoft Civility Survey, which shows that 80% of LGBTQ+ people encountered an abuse online. And one thing that I've seen people talk about when they're discussing protecting LGBTQ people is, like, this tension between protecting them from abuse and over censoring or over moderating, especially because conversation in queer spaces often looks and feels very different. When we talk about making spaces safer, I don't think it's as simplistic as just censor more or flag more things as potentially abuse, because that can also disproportionately affect the community in negative ways.
100%. And I think that there's an interesting debate that tends to go on inside tech companies when they approach these types of issues. And it doesn't necessarily have to be for the queer community specifically, but generally when they think about specific product interventions or policy changes for specific cohorts or demographics of people, which is, how do you think through what the harms are in general But then what are the potential disproportionate harms that are occurring? So this digital civility survey that you mentioned that Microsoft has been doing for a few years. So in that survey, we do see some interesting statistics on the differences and disproportionate harm here. For the queer community, we're looking at cyberbullying and harassment. It comes in at 33% versus 18% on average. And then sexual solicitation for queer participants, it was 31% versus 13% on average. So there are ways to dig into these specific issues for particular demographics or for minority groups. And there are many ways in which other companies are doing this, especially, I think, nowadays from an equity lens. So you can see Meta, for example, they have a Lift Black Voices information hub where you can get access to creators from the Black community and raising equity concerns there. A number of people, especially in the VR and metaverse space right now, are thinking really critically about how self-representation can come through for various races and ethnicities, from various gender identities, from various religions, et cetera. So these questions are being thought about in pretty critical ways, I think, at a lot of places now. It's just a matter, I think, of how a company comes at prioritizing and then addressing any given issue and how exactly you can measure that and then make sure that that gets worked on in a given half or a given year.
It's so hard. just figuring out how to prioritize in general in trust and safety, regardless, you know, I think most people would agree it's often a matter of triage, and there's so many different issues and there's so many different groups and there's so many different problems. And so then, yes, figuring out how to prioritize. One thing that I'm encouraged by is we're starting to see a lot more information sharing throughout the industry so that different companies, and especially smaller companies, don't need to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's some interesting research and efforts that are coming, especially out of the civil society right now. So, for example, GLAAD has released, yes, I think for 2 years now, they have the Social Media Safety Index. And to your point about cross-industry sharing, one of the biggest difficulties I think we have is not only that we're sharing particular bits of information from given case studies within companies, and then maybe other companies can adapt those for their own purposes, but looking at kind of competitive analyses across different platforms and doing these comparisons to show what exactly are the trends in the industry, how are certain companies maybe coming at a problem from one side of the coin or the other. And I think one of the interesting things about the Social Media Safety Index is they score a bunch of platforms across a number of different measures. So this includes things like protection against hate and harassment, offering different expression features, for example, pronouns on profiles, doing more financial and defensive mechanisms like prohibiting advertising that could be harmful or discriminatory. And what they find is that across every single platform that they look at, in a total of a possible 100 score, everyone falls under 50. So that's sad, unfortunately, but just the fact that this kind of comparative framework was done means that we now have a standard by which we can start to investigate this more, and that other companies can say, hey, here's like our risk assessment. Here's what other companies are at right now. And then maybe we can actually do some cross-industry efforts to get everyone ahead of that game a little bit together rather than necessarily doing it all in-house.
Yeah, I love their safety index, and I actually scored my own team against it privately. So I didn't ask them to do it, but I went through the whole thing and I was like, okay, check, check, check. Oh, no. Okay. We're going to work on that a little bit and think about it. So it was really helpful for me, even as somebody who wasn't specifically called out by their index. They're doing some cool work. It's probably worth noting now that Jenny, who's from GLAAD and worked on that project, you, me, and Professor Oliver are all going to be together on a panel at TrustCon talking about some of the stuff as well. And thank you very much for organizing that, Alex.
Yeah.
Do you want to give some more background on that?
Really exciting. So the four of us will be doing a panel at TrustCon, which is coming up soon. If you'll be there, I think we're on day two. And the panel will be focused on LGBTQ trust and safety issues, both in terms of doing more defensive work, as well as more positive things like expression and social support and information seeking. So I'm really excited about this panel, the two of us coming from industry, Glad being represented from the civil society side of things, and then Oliver, who is a professor at Michigan, who has done a lot of trans-inclusive design and human-computer interaction work. So if you're going to be at Trust Fund, come by. We'll be excited to see you there.
I think that's maybe the first plug we've had on this podcast for an event. So not sponsored by TrustCon. We're just excited to talk about this stuff more. I want to throw that out there. So the safety index is one example of how companies can start thinking through risks. Then, you know, what's the next step for people? What are kind of the minimal things that early stage companies can do, and how can and should companies prioritize that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think for many companies, they don't necessarily even know where to start from any kind of demographic or cohort analysis. What I've experienced working in the tech industry for a while is when we try to think about the impact that our platforms are having on people, a lot of the approaches that we tend to take will generate a bunch of metrics or maybe doing some research. But when it comes to evaluating the actual products that get launched, we tend to look at the impact in terms of averages. And so I think the first step is really instigating the internal processes that a company has to see if you can understand what those impacts and effects look like across different groups of people. So this could literally be as simple as looking at basic demographics, like age, gender, race, and ethnicity. It can be even as high level as looking at different countries, but just starting to make sure that our internal systems are capable of doing these cohort analyses to really dig in to see, are we seeing different effects across different types of people, across different demographic groups, et cetera. Second, I think, is making sure that there's a unified front between the teams that are really supposed to care about these. So from the product side, from the policy side, bringing in our XFN, like legal and comms, making sure that we have a front that says, here's what we're going to care about. And this can be applied to the LGBTQ+ community. It can be applied to literally every other type of social impact initiative as well. Third, though, I think, is when we start to get into what can we do specifically to address the concerns, harms, or even opportunities that we might have for a given group that we want to specifically focus on. There, I think there's a couple of different perspectives that we have. So one is we go deep into research. We can either look at a lot of the academic research that's been done in the space for many decades, but also really prioritizing and generating original research that might specifically focus on the queer community. Second is doing, as a component of that, really deep co-design with members of the community itself. So we can obviously go out and find research participants and try and understand what their issues are, but to really drive towards the best possible product outcomes that solve these problems for these communities, we want to make sure that people actually have a say in that. And so developing workshops and other opportunities to bring in that co-design element, I think, is really key. And then third, I think, is making sure that we have a way to measure the impact over time so that if certain things come up, whether they're external events that are just happening in society or maybe things that could be instigated on our platform specifically, that we have ways to flag that in a way that we can escalate them and address them appropriately. There's also, I think, a fourth category, which relates to just generally making sure that we're aware of the problems that we know are happening now. So this is things like policy development, specifically around LGBTQ+ relevant issues. I think one specific example here would be for the transgender community in particular, looking at dead naming and misgendering as a core component of that. You see some platforms like TikTok really stepping up on that in the past couple of years. And other types of problems that I think, again, speak to this question of what are the disproportionate harms that are happening for the queer community? And how can we make sure that not only are we getting ahead of problems that might be happening, but for the problems that we know are happening right now, that we actually have appropriate ways to address them and potential solutions as well.
The policy against misgendering and dead naming is so small in some ways. Like, it's literally, you can put 5 lines in your community guidelines and yet it can make such a big difference for people, just feeling seen. So that's an important one.
Yeah. And I think that element of feeling seen is really key to how we even think about how we can address certain types of these problems inside tech companies. Because at the end of the day, like, a lot of these issues don't get raised until usually one person from the community speaks up. No one really ever has a process by which every single product gets evaluated for every single potential risk. That would be great in the ideal world, but that's just not how it usually works. And so making sure that I think we have like processes for doing integrity style reviews as products are about to be launched is great, but also making sure that there are ways to really identify and then escalate specific issues that might not be super prevalent, but have much higher levels of severity. And usually those are speaking directly to the experiences that a lot of minorities, both LGBTQ plus users, as well as other minorities, have on our platforms. And I think the larger risk here is it's hard to make a case from a business perspective that focusing on those low prevalence, high severity issues is super important. And honestly, in the wider industry right now, we don't have a lot of empirical evidence that says that if you focus on those quote unquote smaller issues, that it returns some kind of ROI at the end of the day. But from a user perspective, we're talking about increasing trust, increasing safety, increasing just confidence and agency in people's participation on the platform. And so there are ways, I think, that we're not quite measuring in the best way the effects and the ways in which we can support the queer community and others by really digging into these issues and improving them over time. But I feel confident that if we are able to focus on them more, and I think specifically using certain personas from more marginalized or historically underrepresented groups, that will help our product teams think much more deeply about the effects that our platforms are having. And by addressing the problems that people from minority groups have, we'll be addressing the larger problems that all people have as well.
Absolutely. And there's also this vicious cycle, which is when you don't address things directly in community guidelines, or you're not directly acknowledging them as a problem yet, then it's really hard to measure them. And if you don't have the trust from users, if they don't actually believe the platform is going to follow through and take action on a certain kind of report, then they're not going to report that to the platform. And so then the platform is going to be like, well, we don't have a problem with issue X because nobody's reporting it to us. And so then they don't prioritize it, when in fact it may be happening quite a fair amount. People just aren't telling you because they don't trust you and they don't trust that you're actually going to do something about it. And so I think that's something to be really aware of too, is that just looking at user reports isn't necessarily giving you a good sense of what people are feeling and what people are thinking. And then, you know, the user trust thing, I think, is especially worth digging into, because that's something that isn't even necessarily just limited to user interactions with each other, but it's also, do people trust you enough to give you their credit card number and pay for your services? Do they trust the company enough to go on and use it every day? Like, the key core metrics in businesses, like engagement and retention and subscription rates and all of those things, I think are built on trust as well as a bunch of other factors. So it's really hard to pick apart, like you said, be able to measure that ROI, but I agree with you that I think it's there.
Yeah. And I'd love to dig into the reporting and content moderation angle a little bit more deeply. I think there's one key aspect to really internalize that a lot of people don't necessarily think about, which is, yes, reporting in general is how we rely on understanding user problems in many cases, and especially to take down violating content. We usually rely on those in addition to some proactive efforts as well. But when people lose confidence in that system, it means that we basically go from some signal to going completely in the dark. This, I think, is particularly an issue for the queer community because so many people have been burned by content moderation in the past, whether it's false positives or we report something that is so obvious to people who are inside the community, and then it gets returned to us as a not violating issue, even though it either is violating or hasn't necessarily been covered explicitly in a given policy. When that happens, the lack of confidence that gets generated, not only for the individual, but for the wider community, because we talk about this all the time, that just leads to a hugely detrimental cycle of these issues continually not getting flagged, continually not getting addressed. And then when people see that they're not getting addressed, they stop spending time on these platforms, they stop feeling confident that they're safe, and they start to look for other alternatives. So at the end of the day, I think one of the best areas that we could probably be focusing on is not only understanding what these abuses look like in terms of behavior or actors or networks, but really digging into what kind of tools are we building for people to give them stronger agency and a better sense of confidence that platforms can actually protect them, and making sure that those systems are robust, not only to just the technicalities of the system itself, but that the use cases are working, that when people identify issues that are affecting their communities so significantly, and it's so obvious for people who are inside those communities, that the people who are moderating it on the other side are able to recognize that those are harms, and the people who are developing the policies are able to recognize that those are harms as well. And I'm not quite sure that we're there yet for every single platform. There's definitely some development that I've seen in the policy space in the past few years that it's slowly getting there. But there is, I think, this question largely of how much are we missing because we're not able to fully, I think, get information from people who are experiencing these harms from their perspective specifically.
Yeah, and that goes back to not just looking at user reports, but talking to people, talking to your customers, listening to them, looking at unsolicited feedback that you're getting through customer support channels or social media or other places, doing user interviews. All of those things can dig out some of those issues and give you a better sense. And you know, sometimes the first step to fixing a problem is not just we have less user reports in this area, but is actually we have more user reports in this area, because it means that people are aware that we'll take action and they trust us and they're telling us about these problems. And then you start to hopefully see a drop after that. But I think that's something to keep in mind. Success sometimes looks like, quote unquote, like worse data or larger numbers, where it's actually a good thing.
One area too that's really interesting that we haven't touched on explicitly yet too is this question of data collection. And I think for people who identify as LGBTQ+, there is this larger concern about, one, being categorized, which is just generically like there's such a complicated and honestly violent history of data collection for underrepresented groups, both in the US and globally. But then when we think about systems that do categorize people, how are we able to both use them respectfully to not harm specific communities, but then also hopefully use them in beneficial ways to actually raise stakes inside companies so that we can actually measure the problems that people are encountering? So I think one of the interesting things about a lot of the privacy and data policies that are coming out from Europe right now is they actually restrict a lot of the ability for us to do this kind of critical work inside companies. I think that there is a case to be made that there should be more data sharing and academic collaborations. But if someone inside a company or a team inside a company really wants to work on these issues, things like GDPR actually make that really difficult, because the collection of sensitive data characteristics about individuals is a restriction. And so there's a lot of really interesting work that kind of goes into like queer data theory. And if we as a community want data to be collected about us, completely valid set of points there. There is also, I think, a practical question of how do we best measure and address these problems if measurement itself is an issue? And I want to make sure that we're able to truly understand how our platforms are affecting different communities all around the world. This is one of the most important questions, I think, in today's world, especially with all this regulation coming through, that really does focus on what is the impact of these platforms. But what makes it complicated is the ways in which we can measure and at what granularity and how ethical and responsible that process can be. It's a hugely important area that I think we need to be focusing more on.
Yes, it's very complicated, and that's well said. For anybody who's listening who is a trust and safety practitioner, maybe wants to propose new initiatives at their company or start thinking about this community more, what are some good first steps for people? What are some things that companies have done that have been super awesome that you want to highlight?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think one of the first steps is just to make sure that inside the company, there's a better stance on how you can create a community of stakeholders to really drive forward these kind of initiatives. So when I think about this, obviously we're thinking about people within safety teams, within policy teams who have the kind of operational expertise to work on them, but then also honestly engaging with employee resource groups, whether they are queer, LGBTQ plus focused, or if it's a different historically underrepresented group, like obviously bringing them in too, because having those perspectives is vital to both making sure that company leadership is able to fully understand and empathize with people's perspectives, but really driving forward people's experiences, especially in the review process, once things start picking up, to identify certain edge cases or potential risks that could be happening that people who are maybe not members of the community are not able to immediately kind of call out. So for example, when I was at Meta, we had a relatively large both Pride at group as well as a trans and non-binary group as well. And so we would regularly bring in members to help look through our product review processes and provide direct feedback to product teams about certain things that they were working on, whether they were specifically targeted to the LGBTQ plus community or not. So again, just to summarize that point, bringing in people with the perspectives that are really driven by members of the community, I think is really, really vital. Second, as we kind of already discussed before, is looking at the wider set of case studies that have already been done across the industry, I think is really helpful because a lot of companies nowadays tend to rely pretty strongly on what's been set as precedent and using those as stepping stones to doing really specific targeted work inside their own company as well. So on both, I think, the trust and safety side, but also more on the like creation side, the expression side, there's just so many different interesting experiments that have kind of come out in terms of product features and policies. And we're not starting at square one anymore. There's just so much out there that we can iterate on at this point. And I think whether it comes to things like misgendering or dead naming policies, but also more expression-oriented features like pronoun, profile expression, doing avatar creation, things like that, as well as just creating resources for the community as well, like LGBTQ plus safety help centers. There's just so much out there at this point that we're no longer at like 10% of the industry working on this. It's probably more like 40 to 50%. And just being able to, I think, iterate on that is going to be really, really helpful. And then third, I would recommend triangulating as much as you can the perspectives of the experts. And so what I mean by this is we kind of have two ends of the spectrum that we can rely on. One is all the experts out in the world. So we have policymakers, we have community members, we have civil society members, we have academics and researchers. There's so much perspective out there that we can rely on. On the other end of the spectrum, we have content moderators who are so close to these issues, and we still don't honestly support them as much as we should be. Both, I think, from a mental wellness perspective, but also they have such close proximity to understanding and seeing these problems that I think we should be engaging much more strongly and deeply with them to really both reveal and measure and then itemize the types of issues that are coming through and illuminate edge cases, do red teaming exercises, because they really are at the forefront of experiencing the issues that are coming through. So, well, I think it's super, super important to rely on a lot of the kind of deep criticism that comes through from policymakers and researchers who are monitoring the types of things externally. We do have other types of experts inside our companies who are working on our content moderation teams. And so I think really bringing them inside of these conversations so that they can teach us more about what they're seeing is really vital. And especially, I think, for addressing issues of marginalized or historically underrepresented groups, they are able to give us a ton of insight into that, that normally I think people might immediately overlook rather than going to them first to understand them better.
That's great. Good insights. I love that you talked about content moderators as well. I started out my career as a hourly, part-time freelance content moderator, and I saw so much stuff, and you know, eventually I've grown my career, but still always have one foot in, you know, the past, remembering what those days were like and remembering how many insights that I had at the time. I have another point with content moderators. If there's anybody here listening who handles operations for moderation teams, a lot of outsourced moderation teams are from pretty traditionally Catholic countries. And sometimes moderators from those countries, or just the countries in general, are fairly transphobic or homophobic or uncomfortable with LGBTQ content, or might judge it as more sexual than non-LGBTQ content, even if it's very comparative. And so thinking about making sure that you really invest a lot of time training moderators and hiring moderators, talking to outsource companies and making sure they partner and bringing on people who are going to be unbiased and fair and understand policies and are checking their own cultural biases, I think is something that is a good exercise as well and can make an immediate difference, because you can have the best policies in the world, but if the people enforcing them are biased or haven't been trained thoroughly enough, then policies don't get enforced super accurately. So just wanted to throw that out there as well, because that's something that I've worked on in the past.
Yeah, and I think that there's a segue too there about just the international component of this for the queer community as well, which just the reality that being gay, being queer, is illegal in many countries still. And that has huge implications, I think, not only for the types of abuses that people encounter on a bunch of our platforms, but also what we, and I really hate to say this, but quote unquote, realistically can do, because conflicting with local laws is a huge area of policy that many companies still don't feel super comfortable with. So one area there that I think makes a lot of this really complicated is just the lack of local support and I think oversight that both policymakers and civil society can have. And so in some ways, tech companies can lead on being able to protect their users maybe much more than a local government would be able to. But at the same time, it really restricts, I think, the ways in which companies feel comfortable by providing specific features or maybe expression product features to particular user bases in particular countries because of the risks that could happen. There was actually a really interesting case study from Match Group where they were doing travel alerts for people inside of their platforms who might be going into a particular region where LGBTQ community members face particularly present dangers because of government restrictions or illegality. And they basically took a stance that said, we are not going to give certain features to certain users because we are concerned for your physical safety. And that is a very political move to make. And I'm sure many people in the LGBTQ community would feel very bad about that decision. But at the same time, you have to weigh these like really tense balancing between what the platform's responsibility is versus what the reality on the ground is. And I think at the end of the day, there's like no real quote unquote good solutions here that can make everyone happy as much as we would like it to turn out that way. So I think a lot of the kind of key questions that are happening in the international space for the queer community at this point are just very difficult operational questions on if a company is willing to take certain risks for both their business as well as for their user base. And so I think what we see is a lot of civil society, especially, and community members stepping up to provide community-driven resources around digital security, around connecting people with local groups. If people get arrested, giving them tips and resources on how to lock your phones, keep things encrypted, et cetera, et cetera. But it's just a really difficult situation for a lot of people in our community in a lot of countries around the world still. And even though digital technology can, I think, give people access to really critical life-saving information, we're talking about getting arrested, getting killed is a very common experience for many people still.
Yeah, at Grindr, we have a 5-point scale that we rank countries on depending on risks to the community. And then we have additional features. We send out safety warnings, sometimes daily in some areas, to alert people to what's going on, as well as like working with local on the ground activist groups. If there's any kind of acute situation that we need to tell people about, we'll be like, you need to know it's always bad, but today it's extra bad. And here's some information and here's what you need to know to keep yourself safe. And it comes back to what you were saying earlier around data and privacy, because, you know, for people in those areas or people who are in safer areas but aren't out yet, privacy is safety for the queer community. If you're scared of being outed to your boss or scared of being arrested just because of who you are, then privacy is so incredibly important. And having the controls to be able to reveal what you want to who you want and when is really critical. Safety and privacy are two sides of the same coin. In the LGBTQ community, I think there's many, 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 many use cases where they're exactly the same thing. Like there actually is no conflict. There's a lot of agreement around where privacy is important. So something else that's pretty unique about the community, especially.
Yeah. And I would say that there's one specific thing to dig in on there too, which is we've talked a lot so far about being a member of the community and it being Pride Month and being able to celebrate the fact that we are members of these communities. But there are people who are still trying to figure out that element of their identity, who haven't come out and are utilizing our platforms to be able to explore their identity and really embrace who they are truly. And I think a lot of the conversations that get talked about when we're thinking about quote unquote solutions or opportunities to really bring in things that could help the LGBTQ plus community largely don't really think too much about that evolution process of finding who you are. And right. There's a lot of, I think, like opportunity for platforms to think a little bit more about how they can support people, either getting access to resources, finding social support and communities, so that people who aren't out yet and aren't comfortable and need that extra layer of privacy are able to do that exploration for themselves and hopefully be able to figure out what exactly is their place in the community if they feel like that's a good fit for them.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything else you want to end with? I think we've covered a very wide range of topics. I'll put links in all the show notes for everybody so that they have an idea of what we're talking about, can dig in with more details and things.
We definitely covered a lot. And I just a reminder again for the plug that we will be at TrustCon coming up in a few weeks. So if you find that you'll be there, we do have our LGBTQ plus panel, and really looking forward to meeting anyone who wants to come say hi to us.
Thank you so much, Alex, for talking with me, and happy Pride to you.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Happy Pride as well.
If you enjoyed this conversation, please share this episode with your friends. It helps us continue making more episodes for you. Today's episode was produced by Talha Baig. I'm Alice Hunsberger. Music by Zhao Shen. Special thanks to everyone at the Integrity Institute for their continued support.